Well, thank you for coming today. We're going to go ahead and start our class. This is kind of a modern marketing technique on Eric's part. He figured that we might get a few more people to show up for class if it smelled real good back here. So if you wandered in for the food, we are going to have a class. You're not required to be here, and you can get more food anytime that you wish. There are no rules or anything like that. But while we're here, we're going to talk a little bit about the Bible, and then we're going to talk a little bit about the history of Christianity. We've been following the history of the church from the Old Testament all the way to the present. And what we're in right now is we've been looking at the Middle Ages, a time when, at least to the historians, that Christianity equals these two big medieval churches. What we're particularly interested in, having studied that the last couple weeks, is we're kind of interested in all these hundreds of years of medieval history. Wasn't there anybody who felt that you could have something better? Wasn't there anybody who felt that you could worship God in a simpler way? Wasn't there anybody who was making some kind of efforts? And the answer is absolutely, of course. It's always been the case that God has had people who sought Him for His own reason. Now, they have sought Him in many different ways. They have had many different ideas about what that meant, but that's a powerful idea. There's never been a time when there weren't some people who really believed in God. And what we're going to do today, we're going to take a look at some Isaiah and Zechariah, and then we'll have a little historical survey of some of the most well-known efforts during the Middle Ages to return to the New Testament church, or as historians usually call it, restore the New Testament church. I'm going to have Steve lead us in a time of prayer. But if we get one of our elders, it would restore a little bit of dignity to our assembly here, and then we'll get started on our study.
Would you go to God with me in prayer? Lord, we're so thankful that we have the opportunity to first be called your sons and daughters, to gather together as a family, to sit at your feet, to open your word, and to drink in your wisdom. Because, Lord, it reminds us of your promises for us, both in this world and in the next. It reminds us of your grace and the forgiveness that you bring to our lives. And most of all, it reminds us of the love that you have for each and every one of us. That you care for us, that you hurt when we hurt, and you rejoice when we rejoice. Lord, we pray that you'll open our hearts as Mark shares with us the history of your body. We pray, Lord, that we can learn both good things and bad things from your body in times past, and that we can use that understanding as we go forward and try to live the life that you would have us to reach out as you would have us to, and to look forward to being with you one day, in Christ's name. Amen.
All right. Thank you very much. We've been studying the Middle Ages, when the early church, as we see it in the scriptures and as we know it from the first couple centuries AD, has changed into something very different. There are these two very powerful, very domineering, very conformist churches, the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church. What we're going to look at today is some of the persons who tried to come up with something a little bit better. But before we do that, we want to get a little bit of scriptural perspective, because one of the things that we sometimes miss is that there's a lot of people who have been trying to do the right thing and who did something very valuable and something that pleased God very much, but it didn't look or sound or seem exactly the same as the way we do things. And that tends to unsettle us a little bit. And I've even read a lot of the histories of the churches of Christ who will talk about some of these ancient attempts to restore the New Testament church, and instead of learning from them, they just want to tell you why they were wrong. They just want to tell you, well, this is what they missed, and here's where we got it right. And what we want to do is have a more gracious perspective on that, and I hope even a more gracious perspective on these established churches, stifling as they were sometimes the spiritual growth. Isaiah 37 and Zechariah 8 will give us some perspective. These actually come in two situations that in some sense are similar. where it seemed as if there were just an awful lot of problems. It seemed like as if there were just no way ever to get back to where things used to be. Norma, I'd like to have you read. Do you prefer Isaiah or Zechariah?
Isaiah.
Then you can have the Isaiah passage.
You're just saying that.
What did he say?
You can deal with him later. You can take care of him later. I know you do.
Isaiah was my friend.
Isaiah is my pal too. I enjoy him. So could you read Isaiah 37, 30 to 32? And then Peggy, I know you're easier to please, so I'll just give you Zechariah. You can take Zechariah 8, 6 to 12. These are two different historical settings, but they have some themes in common. And one of the things that I think it's helpful to do in studying history is to realize that there have been many different eras in history and situations in history where the same spiritual principles still come into play. So I kind of deliberately picked some different situations. Go ahead and read them right back to back, even though they're a little different. Great, thanks very much. Now, I'll describe the historical context in a minute or so, but before doing that, did you see anything in common in those two passages? Words or phrases or ideas or teachings or principles? Anything that seemed to be the same in those two passages?
Remnant.
Okay, remnant obviously stood up. He's talking in Isaiah 37, he says a remnant will take root. In Zechariah, he talks about an inheritance for the remnant. He talks about the remnant in both cases. So in both cases, there's this concept of, yes, the nation as a whole is in dire condition, but there's always going to be a remnant. That's one powerful idea. Anything else you notice?
God Almighty
is in charge. It mentions very strongly in both times that God is in control. It's up to God. It's going to have to do with what God does, not so much with what the people do. This is going to be God who they're going to rely on. It's going to be, of course, hoped for on God's part that they will be faithful to Him and trust Him, but no matter what else happens, God is in control. And it's because of that that they can count on these promises being fulfilled, because it's not going to depend on them. So that's a good one, too. Let's see. Let's take a look at Zechariah 8:12 and Isaiah 37:31. There's a particular word in there. Word or words. Zechariah 8, the seed will grow well and the vine will yield its what?
Fruit.
Its fruit. And back in Isaiah 8:31, a remnant is going to take root below and do what?
Yield
fruit above. Fruit is a symbol of what? It's actually, you can peek on your outline. It's the last line on the first section there. Fruit is a symbol of life and of growth. In other words, it's promising not just survival of the remnant, but what? But that we'll live and grow. And these are things that are promises from God that also apply in a spiritual sense, in any situation. We sometimes look at the spiritual condition of the world or of our nation or even of our church perhaps and become concerned and worried and upset, and we feel like unless they immediately put my plan into action, it's going to just be some horrible disaster. But these scriptures assure us, no, it's God who produces the roots and it's God who produces the fruit. Back in Isaiah 37, this is the lifetime of King Hezekiah. And this is in 701 BC when the Assyrians have attacked Judah. Already the Assyrians have conquered Israel, the northern half of God's people, and they're on their way to destroying Judah as well. And they have conquered pretty much the whole country. They're at the gates of Jerusalem. They're launching a siege. People are panicking. And Hezekiah is the king at this time, and he has decided to consult with Isaiah to ask what to do. Now, it's an interesting thing. This is a pretty horrible situation. So Hezekiah must have done something really stupid to bring it about. Well, if you read in the Chronicles account in 2 Chronicles 32, the chronicler introduces this episode by saying, after all that Hezekiah had so faithfully done, the Assyrians invaded Judah and attacked it. In other words, this is in spite of Hezekiah's faithfulness and his devotion to God. In other words, what it's saying is, a lot of stuff that happens is unfair. We don't like it, but it's unfair. You can't be spiritual enough to prevent every bad thing from happening. And God's promises are different. God doesn't promise if you're faithful, your life will be free of trouble. He promises if you're faithful, I'll protect you spiritually. I'll keep a remnant faithful spiritually. And that's what he's promising in both cases. And they're going to have to rely on God's providence. That's the meaning, by the way, in verse 30, when he says, this year you'll eat what grows by itself, and the second year what springs from that, and only in the third year will you sow and reap and plant vineyards. Did you catch what that means? It's saying that the Assyrian invasion is going to be so devastating, you won't even be able to farm anything for the next couple years. You're just going to have to eat whatever you find. You're not going to be able to get yourself back together to have your usual economic activities. You're just going to have to eat what grows by itself. You're going to basically have to trust God for the next couple of years. We never really have any control over getting our food and our clothing and our homes, but we usually think we do. God usually is gracious enough to us to let us think that we're working hard, and so that's why we have enough food and enough clothes and everything like that. But what he's saying is, this time it's going to be real obvious. It's going to be so bad, you're just going to have to scrounge around, but it's going to be there, so don't worry about it. Do you have a comment? Go with that, Frank. That God is right. He has deliberately allowed these dire situations to occur because there are spiritual lessons that we have to learn from them. Exactly, and we'll get to Zechariah's context in a minute too, because it illustrates your point again. Here in Isaiah, he's promising roots and fruit, and who produces the roots? It's not a trick. God produces the roots, and who produces the fruits? God produces the fruits. We can't take credit for either of them, and they're going to come from God's grace, from God's providence in times of trouble. Over in Zechariah, that's a later era in Israel's history. This is after Hezekiah has done his best. Hezekiah brought Israel eventually a period of peace and relative prosperity, but his son was one of the great snakes of the Old Testament. And his son Manasseh led the nation back into idolatry and trouble, and some years later they were taken over by the Babylonians. In Zechariah's time, a small group of Israelites has returned, and they're trying to rebuild the land. They got to go back in 538 BC because of the benevolence of the Persian rulers who had conquered Babylon, and Zechariah and another group shows up at about 520 BC, and they look around the land, and it's just devastated. all the years of neglect and conquest and war and other disasters. The buildings are all ruined. People have hardly anything to live on. And everyone is just kind of dreaming of the past, how good it used to be. And Zechariah, and also this is what the book of Haggai is also about. Zechariah and Haggai were sent by God to remind the people that it's God who's going to do the rebuilding. And when they looked at this devastated nation and kept telling themselves, who's going to put it all back together? How are we ever going to get all this work done? How are we going to get the temple back? How are we going to get these buildings back? How are we ever going to have things back the way they were? We just can't do it, so we're just going to sit here and mope about it. Not that we would ever do such a thing. But this is why these prophets came along and said, now hang on a second. In verse 6 of Zechariah 8, it may seem marvelous, amazing, incredible to you, but will it seem marvelous to me? God's not going to be surprised by it, because God's been doing this for millennia, rebuilding our messes, cleaning up the disasters that we cause, bringing us back to Him despite our own sinful natures. God has been fixing human messes for many centuries now, and He can do it again. It's not a surprise to God that He can rebuild. And He has a specific phrase here that He's going to bring back His people from the east and from the west. This is for verse 7. In His time, what He meant is the Israelites had been scattered by war and captivity, and He's going to bring them back and once again rebuild the nation of Israel. And there's a good spiritual parallel to it, because in the New Testament we also learn about how God wants to call people from all over the world, from the east and from the west and the north and the south, and every place where humans live are called to Jesus to be reunited or to be united in the spirit of Jesus at the foot of the cross. And He's talking about, again, that God is going to give the life and the growth. He talks in verse 12, the seed is going to grow, the vine's going to yield its fruit, the ground's going to produce its crops, the heavens are going to drop their dew. I give all these things as an inheritance to the remnant of this people. It's similar to what Jesus talks about in Matthew 6. This was actually Ron's sermon last week, and I make special mention of it because this is my wife's favorite passage in the whole Bible. Ron picked it for a sermon last week. It's because it talks about, remember what Ron's title was? What animals are represented in this passage? It talks about birds. It talks about all kinds of birds, and then it talks about God's providence, and it talks about how if we trust in God, we can overcome our anxieties, we can overcome our worry. Do not worry about tomorrow. That's Linda's favorite verse in the scripture, because each day has enough trouble of its own, because it's a combination of assurance and wisdom, because each day surely does have enough trouble of its own. It makes little sense to worry so much about tomorrow. And it talks in that passage about how the birds and nature, they don't have to make all these special efforts and worry about things the way that we do, and they still get what they need. And this is what God is saying. The spiritual application is that we so often, and we're going to connect it with the church history here too, we so often think that it depends on us figuring it all out, on us getting it right, on us being good, on us not making the mistakes that those other people made. And so we tend to apply these very arbitrary and unreasonable standards both to ourselves and to other people who are trying to seek God. In the contemporary, our own time and place, we tend to have a lot of unnecessary anxiety about us and other people, and are they getting it right? Are we getting it right? Here's what they're doing wrong. I think we're doing this wrong too. Instead of trusting God to bring the fruit and to grow roots for us by His grace, which is what He has always promised to do. And when we are anxious and insecure about ourselves, when we judge ourselves and aren't confident in what God's going to do for us, we tend to have the same standard towards other people and pass judgment on them and look at all the things they're doing wrong and think that, well, we're messing things up pretty bad, but at least we're better than those characters down the road, aren't we? Well, when we look at history, as we kind of transition into our historical survey, we're going to look at some of the medieval fellowships and individuals who felt that there could be a better way of seeking God than through these monolithic medieval churches that we've been studying about. And it's very valuable to have a gracious perspective and gracious expectations, because we're not going to find the medieval equivalent of the churches of Christ. We're not going to find the five acts of worship. We're not going to find the verse that talks about the preacher wearing a suit and tie and using a microphone. We're not going to find the verses that tell us that all the things that we don't like you can't do and all the things we like you can do. There's none of that at all. It's just people who felt that their need was for God and not human authorities telling them what to do. It's just people who felt that we can do better than these conformist human authority churches that are just stifle spiritual growth. They had a lot of different ideas. And one of the things that's a basic in any history is that winners get to write the history. There were a lot of faithful brothers and sisters back in the Middle Ages who sacrificed and risked a lot to try to return to New Testament Christianity, or if you like the phrase, to restore New Testament Christianity. None of those groups survived. They're all gone. Most of them were deliberately wiped out. And the history books were written by the people who wiped them out. And so we can't expect to even see all the good things that they probably did that have been lost. There's also a lack of direct link to the present. We don't have a direct link to any of these people. We trace the Churches of Christ go back to the early 1800s with Protestant groups that had split off from the medieval Catholic Church some years before. Well, we can kind of trace some kind of a artificial human genealogy back to certain denominations, but we can find no direct link at all with these people. That really doesn't mean anything whatsoever, because the link of having the desire to seek God rather than human religion should be stronger to us than any artificial genealogy. The fact that these people did not establish long-term numerical growth, well, that contradicts our American worship of success. In the Churches of Christ, that's certainly been a disease ever since I've been a part of them, the worship of numerical growth, that if it brings growth, it must be right, and if it doesn't bring growth, it must be wrong. Well, a lot of these groups have an even bigger excuse than us for not growing in the long term, because they were deliberately persecuted, and the people who belonged to them were deliberately slaughtered. And then again, the history books were written by the people who did that. There's kind of a vague parallel in our own country's history, because you read conventional histories of the United States and there are a lot of distortions and oversimplifications that everybody accepts, because it just seems inevitable that we should become powerful. Of course, we should have become powerful. You read in our own nation's history about the Native American tribes who once were extremely prosperous, extremely numerous, and then they were deliberately wiped out and marginalized. And the histories were written by the people who did those things. So of course it's going to make it sound as if, yeah, there was something wrong with them. They were savages. They were deficient. Well, that's kind of similar to what we have left of the medieval history groups. The Native American tribes are so marginalized that even the most liberal of our politicians, as self-interested as these political parties and politicians are, no one cares about them because there are just not enough votes involved. There's not enough votes involved to make an issue out of the horrible things that were done to them, which are even worse than the horrible things that were done to other minorities in this country's history. Same thing's true about the medieval restoration movements. There ain't anybody left to speak for them. There's nobody left to present their case. And yet there were millions of faithful brothers and sisters who risked a lot. And it's worth taking the time to give them a little bit of a belated appreciation. A lot of external differences. You can easily pick them apart. Well, they were wrong about baptism, and those guys were wrong about the Spirit, and those guys were wrong about prophecy. But that really isn't as important as the fact that they had a common goal with us. They looked at the so-called religious world and the secular world of their time and said, there's a better way to seek God than this. So with that in mind, and with, I hope, the spirit of and expectations of grace, just a little survey of some of the medieval fellowships and teachers who tried to return to or restore New Testament Christianity. And if nothing else, by the way, later in the fall we'll talk about the history of the Churches of Christ and the Christian Church and the Disciples of Christ. You know what? Most of those guys that started those fellowships would not be welcome in the Churches of Christ or the Disciples of Christ or the Christian Church today, because they had some pretty bizarre views. They had some pretty crazy views on things. They would disturb you. Some of the things that they thought about prophecy, some of the things they thought about the proper role of women in the church. Some of them would unsettle many of you very much, and they would not be welcome in most good, God-fearing Churches of Christ today. So that's just something to keep in mind, too, that it's really not, the issues and the right and wrong are much less important than the desire to seek God, seek God's presence, snap out of human religion, whatever form it may take. And that's what I hope we can appreciate about these brothers and sisters in the Middle Ages, because they took big risks to do it. We take comparatively few risks to have to seek God instead of human religion. One of the things that you find early in the Middle Ages, there are a lot of holdout churches. This process that we've described of how the medieval churches came to be so politically powerful, so wealthy, and so conformist, and so oppressive, that did not apply universally. There are a lot of holdout churches. A lot of people at the time were worried about that. And especially well into the Middle Ages, in some of the areas where the mainline churches could exert less control, there were a lot of churches who stayed very close to the New Testament pattern. One of the sad ironies of history is because they were in remote areas where the powerful European governments and the Byzantine government couldn't impose their way of doing things, meant that those areas were also exposed to attack. There were many holdout churches in the British Isles, in Northern Africa, and Ethiopia that for many years held to a simple New Testament pattern, at least in a lot of important ways, but then those churches were then destroyed by either the Vikings or the Muslims when those invasions took place in the early Middle Ages. One of the exceptions to the destruction is Ethiopia, because Ethiopia has always been kind of a unique part of the world, and there was an Ethiopian church that basically, you could trace it back. It's changed a great deal. It's probably not what you could call a true New Testament church anymore, but it has always had its own independent history. Ethiopia managed to escape the worst of the Muslim attacks, and it managed to stay far enough away from the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church to be bossed around. So the Ethiopian church is very unique. It's very unusual, very interesting history. There were also, in the Middle Ages, a lot of mission churches. A lot of mission churches began by the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church that were planted in places, again, far away from the mother churches, far away from where there was any kind of political control. It's one of the positive things about the medieval churches, especially the Catholics, their devotion to missions. You know, the medieval Catholic Church took the gospel to far bigger areas of the world, even than the first and second century Christians did. They introduced the church in many places where there was no political protection at all for Christians. And a lot of those early missionaries or medieval missionaries, they weren't stupid. They realized when they went to China or to some place in Eastern Asia that they couldn't impose Roman Catholicism on these people. Now, some of them kind of turned the Christian religion into something that just was more appealing to their native religions, but some of the missionaries also decided, let's just try teaching the gospel and see if that works. Let's just teach them about Jesus, tell them he died for their sins, see if that grabs anybody's attention. And there were a lot of churches that started on that basis alone. Now, if you track them through the Middle Ages, they take many different directions after that. Of course, after they were formed, Catholic authorities would try to get them now to become Catholics. Of course they would try to do that. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. A lot of these churches, again, suffered the fate of trying to maintain a New Testament approach, the simple gospel of the cross and the resurrection, and a lot of times they paid the price for it. One of the long-forgotten stories took place in the Congo. In the late 1400s, there was a Portuguese Catholic mission to the Congo that was very successful, and they started a church there, and in fact, they appointed the nephew of the ruler of the Congo to become the first African bishop since the ancient church. And this guy, Enrique, and his uncle, they were very excited about this, and one day they just kind of realized, when they were studying the scriptures, you know, Catholicism really isn't very close to the Bible. Maybe we should do something a little bit different. And they thought they could explain this to the Portuguese rulers and that they would be pleased with this discovery that they'd made, but they weren't. And it's kind of a sad story if you read about it in the history books, but it shows how powerful that idea is of just returning to the grace of the gospel. Of course, you know that one of the sad things that happened to the Congo was the slave trade, and that was just very destructive to Christianity, and that's one of the reasons why the Portuguese weren't too happy with the Congolese thinking that they could know God themselves. That kind of was in the way of their plans, and that kind of thing happened a lot too. The point, though, is to remember that a lot of these missions, just because they were conducted by Catholics, just because they were conducted by Orthodox, doesn't mean the people who preached the gospel didn't, in many cases, help people come to know Jesus. And as Paul says in Philippians 1, long as Jesus is preached, it's a good thing. We shouldn't fuss with all the details. Well, we're probably especially interested in the larger fellowships that deliberately broke away, deliberately started their own fellowship, their own church, or historians often call them movements, which is a word that I tend to have an allergy to, so I tend not to use it. There were two large Restoration fellowships that broke off from the Orthodox Church. It's kind of an oddity of the Middle Ages that the early Middle Ages, the Orthodox Church tended to be the most fertile ground for people who wanted to go back to New Testament Christianity. As the Middle Ages wore on, they became much more active in the Catholic Church. But very early in the Middle Ages, there was a group called the Paulicians who broke away from the Orthodox Church, beginning in the 6th century. They were called the Paulicians by their enemies. It was not their own name for themselves. They simply wanted to get back to the Bible. They were called the Paulicians because people thought it was very bizarre that these people studied the New Testament, they read the things Paul and Luke and those guys wrote, and they didn't spend their time worshiping saints and icons like good Orthodox are supposed to do. They're Paulicians. They worship Paul. They're wacky. And the name just kind of stuck because they didn't really mind being compared to the Apostle Paul. Who would? So they accepted the name Paulicians. They had basically two things that was their reason for breaking away from the Orthodox Church. They first of all were opposed to church hierarchies. They saw the problems of having this complex arrangements of church officials, one on top of the other, who imposed their will from the top. They saw in the scriptures individual Christians with local leaders who were given responsibility, not authority, to protect their spiritual well-being. And they also were, you'll like this, so you'll bear in mind you won't like some other things about them, but you'll like this. They realized that baptism should be given to only to people who were at least old enough to understand what it meant to follow Jesus. They practiced believer baptism. The practice of infant baptism was not a problem in the ancient church. In fact, as if you remember from the summer, the opposite was the problem. In the ancient church, the progression over time was to delay baptism because they got more and more perfectionist, to the fact that by the 3rd century and 4th century, they would make you wait till you were almost dying to baptize you because they were afraid they'd baptize you and then you'd go and goof it up and you'd be lost again, which is a different problem. But in the late 4th century and the 5th century, with the rise of the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church, they imposed infant baptism because it was much simpler. It was a much simpler way of identifying yourself with the church from an early age. It was an easier way of attracting people's loyalty. Well, the Paulicians were one of the first groups to be concerned with that. And so they basically broke off from the Orthodox Church beginning in the 6th century. There were Paulicians around for several years. They had this book that was anonymously written called The Key of Truth, which they studied along with the Bible. It's kind of not a lot different from some of the bestsellers that become fads in the church and everybody reads and everybody spends more time talking about some bestseller than about the scriptures. So they made a few mistakes. They became involved in some of the Eastern religions at the time, later on in their history, that kind of derailed them a little bit. But they basically kept these two core beliefs for several centuries. They lasted through most of the early Middle Ages. For a while, they were very viciously persecuted. A couple weeks ago, I talked about Empress Theodora. She had a special hatred for them, and she used to boast about the numbers that she had killed. She would go around boasting, I've killed 10,000 of them now. I've killed 20,000 of them now. She kept changing the sign like they used to do on the McDonald's when we were kids. 20,000 Paulicians killed, 50,000 Paulicians killed, because they just irked her that they wouldn't accept her authority and her husband's authority. And so the Paulicians eventually dwindled out. They're long since lost any traces of them. They eventually got sidetracked and were persecuted out of existence. Many of them also were in areas that were taken over by the Muslims. So they stopped being persecuted by the Byzantines and were persecuted by the Muslims instead. So they left no lasting trace. But this is a story of a group who sacrificed a lot, gave a lot. And it doesn't really matter the fact that they would not see everything the same as us. They were big on prophecy, for example. They were big on spiritualism and what we would kind of consider occultism. But they also were very sincere in wanting to simply worship God. They didn't develop a powerful structure of their own. They just had a loosely organized fellowship of encouragement amongst each other. And for several centuries in the parts of the Byzantine Empire, they kept alive that group of the dream of New Testament Christianity. Frank, do you want to comment something on that?
I think I read one day that they were closer on grace than
Well, they were closer on grace to the fact that it would alarm most of the people in this room how much they believed in grace. Yes, they were very strong on grace, and that, in fact, is one of the things that it's hard to sort through reading the histories about them, since the histories were written by the people who wiped them out. They are portrayed as libertines and as wackos and a lot of other things like that. Happened to Paul, too, in fact, in the New Testament. Paul was accused of being a cheap grace. The next group began in the 10th century in Bulgaria. It's called the Bogomils, and this is, again, a name given to them by their opponents. The name Bogomil is the name of an Orthodox priest who started this, and his movement became the Bogomils. He actually did not care about names and labels, so he never came up with a name for it, and so they're just called the Bogomils because that's what the Orthodox Church called them. He had come into contact with one of the last surviving groups of Paulicians. In the 10th century in Bulgaria, the Paulicians had almost died out at that time, and a small group of them was still in the empire's view causing trouble. And so they shoved them all the way out to Bulgaria, where at the time there wasn't even much of an Orthodox church, and hoped that would get them out of the way. Well, there was an Orthodox priest named Bogomil, whose name in this lot of Slavic languages ironically means beloved of God, who got to know these people. And he said, these guys have something on right here. These guys have some good ideas. And specifically, Bogomil had a slightly different take on what we would call New Testament Christianity. He again rejected the hierarchy of the Orthodox Church. He came to see, you know, when these guys say that God is really interested in individuals knowing him and seeking him, not being told what to believe and not being told what to do, yeah, that's right. That's something important. That's what God wants. God wants us to know him individually. Now, Bogomil did not go so much for the doctrine as they did. His big thing was, to him, individual involvement in the church and knowledge of God was what he came to see as the most important application of that. So the Bogomils became known again for turning aside from this concept of a human hierarchy of leaders, but they became more known for their teaching that each Christian, it's important for them to know God individually. It's important for them to be involved, to make their own sacrifices, and to seek out God in their own way. Bogomil was a lot more aggressive than any of the Paulician leaders. Bogomil was not afraid to give public reproaches of the Orthodox leaders. The Orthodox Church at that time had become very wealthy. It was something Bogomil saw as very alien to the concept of Christianity in the Scriptures, and he taught very aggressively against that. And so, like the Paulicians, his group was persecuted. He had the good fortune to come along at a time when the Byzantine Empire was starting to crumble. The Muslim attacks had weakened the Byzantines, and they could not afford any major efforts on persecuting people within their own borders. And so the Bogomils lasted several centuries. They lasted well into the 14th century. Now, Bogomil had a lot of beliefs that you would, I'm sure, find a problem. Bogomil was perfectly comfortable with infant baptism, for example. He was perfectly comfortable with a lot of other things that might make you uncomfortable. But the key was, since Bogomil rejected church hierarchies, he left it to individual Christians and individual congregations. There were congregations of Bogomils that practiced baptism in exactly the same way we would do it. There were other congregations where they practiced infant baptism. The key thing to Bogomil was people got to know God in their own way. It can't depend on human leaders telling them what to think and what to believe. And so again, I think there's a lot of very positive things that you can get out of that example that they left. Now, later in the Middle Ages, the Orthodox Church, for whatever reason, became a little bit more successful than the Catholic Church in keeping people satisfied. And so as you go through the Middle Ages, it becomes more common to see people from within the Catholic Church returning to this concept of simple New Testament Christianity. And of course, eventually, the Reformation came out of the Catholic Church. There's no real equivalent in the Orthodox Church. The Orthodox denominations today are really very similar, or at least much more similar to what they were in the late Middle Ages than even Catholicism itself is. Even Catholicism itself has changed a lot, much less the groups that came out of it. So these are both coming out of the Orthodox. These are from the Orthodox Church. The Catholic Church towards the high Middle Ages and the late Middle Ages tended to have a wealth of groups that came out of the Catholic Church. So out of Catholicism, and one of the things that's interesting is of all the countries in the Middle Ages, one country was like a hotbed of sentiment to return to the New Testament. The spiritual fervor and the reacting against the oppression of Catholicism, and that was France. France was the country that we would find the religious elite in. From our own point of view, we would think that the French were the ones that really had it on straight in the Middle Ages, because that's where all the great Restoration leaders for many years came from. It's also ironic historically, because in the early Middle Ages, it was the forerunners of the French, the Franks. They were the ones who were one of the most powerful tribes, and they were the ones who overtly allied themselves with the papacy. The Franks were the ones that first propped up the papacy to give it its first big important government to support it, and they were the ones who helped give the popes a lot of power. Later in the Middle Ages, it was the French who decided, this is no good. We have to find something better than this. One of the most well-known groups, and you read about these guys a lot in secular histories, the Cathari, or the Cathars. The name literally means the pure ones. These are written about in a lot of medieval histories, conventional histories, not just Restoration Philip histories, because they were an integral part of the Middle Ages in Europe. They were a group that split off from the Catholic Church about 1100 AD, about AD 1100, with their idea of restoring pure, this was their word, pure New Testament Christianity. Now what they saw that, of course, is always a little bit different anytime someone thinks about that. They saw two things. Again, they saw no hierarchy. We shouldn't have all these humans telling us what to do. And they believed in living a life of zeal and sacrifice. This was the group that actually inspired one of the great monastic movements. Dominic Guzman, about 100 years after the Cathars started, was very worried that the Cathars were drawing so many people away from the Catholic Church. And he was very impressed, even though he believed they were heretics and should be executed if possible. He also was very impressed with their genuine zeal and sacrifice, their lifestyles. He, although he is very faithful Catholic, he saw the error of the sumptuous lifestyle that a lot of the popes and Catholic leaders were living. And he was very impressed by this, and it moved him to start the Dominicans. That's where the Dominican friars came from. It was his attempt to give a Catholic equivalent to show people, hey, look, we can do this too. We can be sincere too. And in fact, Guzman, the Dominicans, actually drew away a lot of Cathars back into the Catholic Church, because there were a lot of people who that was really the reason they joined the Cathars to begin with, because they saw, hey, Christianity is not about wealth and prosperity. And yeah, we're going to do this over here. And the Dominicans actually were one of the forces that kind of ended the Cathars. They also were relentlessly persecuted. The Cathars were an extreme reaction to Roman Catholicism. So there's a lot of things about the Cathars, the Cathari, that we would say, oh, they were wrong about this and they were wrong about that. But if you stop to think about all the things that we do, and some of the sillier of the traditions that we have, as Larry likes to point out, we are allergic to coniferous trees in our fellowship for no real reason other than the fact that it's what denominational churches do. There's no good reason to be allergic to Christmas or Easter or anything. It's just denominational churches do it. We can't do that. Well, if you understand that, you can sympathize a little bit more with the Cathars. They lived in an age when the Catholic Church was so ritualistic, so overcome with conformity. They just reacted against the whole thing. So they rejected the Lord's Supper because of the Catholic Mass had become so ritualized. They rejected baptism because it was a ritual. They practiced conversion by what they called spiritual baptism, which is essentially laying on of hands. Basically, just an extreme overreaction to Catholicism, which we do all the time, so we shouldn't judge them too harshly. The zeal that they had left a lasting legacy, and eventually Pope Innocent III, whom we talked about last time, decided to crack down on them. He actually launched a crusade against them. It's really the only major crusade that was not launched against the Muslims or the Orthodox Church was against the Cathars. And it killed many, many thousands of them, were tortured and killed. And the combination of that and then the Dominicans giving them a little bit of a gentler way back into the Catholic Church kind of brought an end to the Cathars. They only lasted a couple hundred years. But while they were around, they were very influential and very controversial. Actually, if you're a into the history of Britain, that crusade against the Cathars was led by a guy called Simon de Montfort. And if you know your British history, you're familiar with his son who had the same name. His son, Simon de Montfort, was the one who was instrumental in setting up the British Parliament. You know, when they had no representation, he actually had the confrontations with the British monarchy to produce Parliament. His dad, however, went around killing Cathars. A more similar group started again in France a little bit later in the 12th century. In the city of Lyon, France, there was a guy named Peter Waldo. And despite the slightly comical name, he was a very serious person. He was actually a very wealthy merchant in Lyon, France. He was a loyal Catholic, wealthy merchant. He kind of bought into the whole thing that, yeah, God is blessing me with all this wealth because I perform all the rituals and say all the prayers. Except that there came a time in his life, late in his life, when he began slowly to feel a spiritual need. And he had what you would call a spiritual awakening. And he was a very educated man, so he knew Latin, so he could read the scriptures, which they were only available in Latin at the time. And he saw a much different way of seeking God. And he was moved to give away his business, all this massive wealth he'd accumulated. He gave away his home, gave away everything he had, and he devoted his life just to going around talking to people about Jesus. He didn't even go anyplace. He just went around the city of Lyon and then out the French countryside just talking to people about Jesus. He all of a sudden felt this enormous compulsion to let people know that Jesus had died for their sins, that Jesus cared about them, that religion wasn't about ritual, it wasn't about all these rules and doctrines. It was, there actually was a God, and he really does love you whether you do the rituals or not. Well, for a while, he was tolerated by the Catholic authorities because he encouraged people to be sacrificial, he encouraged people to be very moral and upright and not be greedy and selfish, and so the Catholics kind of liked that, even though some of the things that he said he didn't like. Eventually, though, he began to call for people to return to the scriptures, and he believed that so much that he translated the New Testament into several different languages so that people could read it, because at this time you could only read the Bible in Latin, and in fact it was only a short while after this that the Catholic Church made it illegal to read the Bible unless you were part of their clergy. At the time it was just discouraged, and you had to at least learn Latin to do it. So he started translating the Bible into French and other medieval languages so that people could read it. They didn't like that as much. And so they warned him in a council, and then they excommunicated him, and they started chasing him all over Europe, trying to find him and capture him and do horrible things to him. I always thought it was funny. Back in the 90s, there was these kids' game called Where's Waldo? I always thought it was funny because that's kind of what he was playing with them. Where's Waldo? They can't find him. He was kind of an expert at disguise, just like that little funny cartoon character, Waldo. They could never find him. They never got him. And he called his group the Paupere Spiritu, which just means the poor in spirit. He's known to history, although he called them, the poor in spirit is his name. They're called just the Waldenses or the Waldensians, because again, it's one of the old marketing techniques of the establishment. If they call you the name, they're just followers of this guy, Waldo. They used to do that to the Church of Christ in the early 1800s. For a long time, the Church of Christ and the Disciples of Christ and the Christian Church were just called Campbellites. For a long time, the then established churches just called them the Campbellites. They say they're just Campbellites. They're just following this man, just to write them off like that. Well, they did the same thing to Waldo, and so he's known to the history books by the name that his enemies gave him. Well, they lasted for a long time. They lasted well into the Middle Ages. They were the most widespread of all these groups that we're talking about. They extended into not just France and Italy, but all throughout Central Europe. One of the things that's interesting is every place that the Waldenses went, they would always find smaller groups that were trying to return to New Testament Christianity. And the Waldenses were very flexible in their doctrine. Their variance in doctrine was very wide. The one common factor was they didn't build any hierarchy. Nobody was going to boss anybody around. And they believed that the Christians should live according to the New Testament. Simple lifestyle, not interested in worldly gain, not interested in competition with one another. So a lot of these smaller groups then found them a very appealing way of expanding their fellowship. So they actually drew in a lot of smaller groups. There was a larger part of the, not really a part of them, an offshoot in Italy, in Lombardy, Italy, which is a province in northern Italy. There were a lot of smaller groups that had been trying this same kind of return to New Testament, And they were inspired by some people from the Waldenses who came to encourage them, and they formed their own fellowship called the Pauperis Lombardi, the Lombardian Paupers. And they devoted themselves actually to a very high standard of sacrifice and material giving. They actually were communists in the true sense of the word, not in the phony Bolshevik sense of the word. They were true communists. They lived exactly the way that they saw in the book of Acts, and they were around for a while too before they too displeased the authorities enough to have stern action taken against them, because we don't want this thing bad enough that they're not going to be good Orthodox Christians, but it's even worse if they're not going to be good capitalists. We can't have both. There were also, within the Catholic Church itself, there were teachers and leaders in the Catholic Church itself who were very strong voices for change, even though they remained loyal to Catholicism. One of the famous ones, Arnold of Brescia, in the middle of the 12th century. Arnold was another one who, as loyal as he was to the Church, it just disturbed him the fact that the Church had so much wealth and put so much of an emphasis on wealth and power. And he started to call for a reform by the Church. He thought at first that they would listen. They didn't. He kind of widened his call. He was just starting to study the New Testament for other ways that he thought the Church could be better when they decided we don't need this kind of thing around here, so they executed him. There was another guy who's left the last more lasting legacy. You may have heard of this guy, Peter Abelard. He was, again, French. He was a French theologian, very popular writer and teacher. Abelard was, unlike some of these other people, he loved the Catholic Church. He loved the rituals, loved the tradition, loved the history, loved everything about it, loved to teach, loved to talk to people about it. But he loved God more than any of those other things. And he too went through a time of kind of a spiritual awakening when he saw that a lot of the things the Catholic churches were doing, persecuting people, executing people who didn't agree with them, that was really not, that's not the lifestyle of Christ. And he began to use his fame as a teacher and as a writer to teach some things from the New Testament. Well, he was a lot more popular than Arnold was, and so they didn't want to just execute it. And they tried pretty crude methods, though. They tried to discourage him because he had a student. He had this young woman who was in a lot of his lectures, Eloise, and it's actually what most people remember about Abelard. She was a very brilliant young woman, very intelligent and very spiritual herself. And what most people know about Abelard is the letters that these two wrote to each other. The letters of Abelard and Eloise. It's like a literary classic, these beautiful love letters that also talk a lot about God. It's one of the great masterpieces of medieval literature. Well, since she was the niece of an important church official, and he didn't like her having a romance with this heretic. And he hired this squad of thugs to gang up on Abelard and castrate him, which these were not medical professionals. So they didn't follow the proper anesthetic procedures, and so, as modern doctors like to say, he experienced some discomfort. And it also, by Catholic law, it made him ineligible for positions in the church anymore, because that was the rule. You can't have that. So he retired to a monastery and devoted himself full time to writing and teaching and writing and teaching. And he was a real thorn in the side for many years. And he's kind of a bridge, because in the late Middle Ages you kind of see the groundwork of the Reformation, because there's a guy called William of Ockham. We'll talk about him more next week. And what's called the mystics that arose in the late Middle Ages that kind of carried on that scholarly tradition. And they kind of gave the intellectual groundwork for the Reformation. There are some other people that we'll talk about next week. I hope you've heard of John Wycliffe in England. You might not have heard of this guy, but he was actually even more important, Jan Hus in Bohemia. They actually started to do the same thing that Martin Luther tried to do, that because of various times and place and circumstances, they were unsuccessful, but they provided an important example of the desire that not just individuals had to return to God, but a lot of people really were attracted to these people who just talked about God. God was the powerful idea, not the church, not their church, and not our church either. And when you look at these brothers and sisters of ours from the Middle Ages who gave up so much and risked so much, it's a powerful reminder that there's just the simple concept of let's get back to the cross, the resurrection, the grace, the blood, the empty tomb. Let's just focus on that instead of all the doctrines and the persecuting and the arguments. It's a powerful idea that can't be stifled. You can't kill enough people or torture enough people to stop people from thinking about that. And it's a powerful reminder to let ourselves be encouraged by these medieval brothers and sisters, even though they believed a lot of things we don't believe in. And it's a powerful example to let ourselves be encouraged by anyone anywhere today who just wants to know God. Some of you have read this book by Reubel Shelley. It's called I Just Want to Be a Christian. And that's a powerful idea. We'll finish with a little trivia question. This is word trivia. It has to do with the word cardinal. The word cardinal is an interesting word because it has at least five different meanings in English. It can refer to a church official. It can refer to a very pretty bird that is the state bird of Ohio. It can refer to a certain kind of numbers, the cardinal numbers, as opposed to the ordinal numbers. It can refer to a color, cardinal red, or it can refer to something of importance, you know, a cardinal principle, a cardinal rule. But what was the original literal meaning of the word cardinal? Did it mean a chieftain or a prince? Did it mean home? Did it mean hinge? Did it mean powerful? Did it mean colorful or bright? Well, the original meaning in the word in English language, cardinal, first came into our language meaning something of primary importance. But we get it from a little bit more ancient use. A lot of the modern uses just come from that. For example, the bird, the cardinal, it's called a cardinal because it has the same color red that cardinals in the Catholic Church use for their robes. The color cardinal red also comes from Catholic cardinals. If you're a bird watcher, you know there's another bird called the Prothonotary Warbler. It's this really blazing, bright, beautiful orange. That's also named after a prothonotary, which is another position in the Catholic Church. The church official came first. Well, the Catholic concept of a cardinal, originally a cardinal, was, back in the early Middle Ages, was a person who had been promoted to a high position in church, but they were attached to one of the churches in Rome. The original cardinals were the leaders of the churches in the city of Rome who then were under the Pope. The Pope was the boss, the bishop, but they were the cardinals. And they were attached to the church. The original meaning of the word cardinal is a hinge. The Latin word cardo means door, and cardinal or cardini means of the door, which was used to be a hinge. Originally, the cardinals were hinged to a church. Now, that long ago lost that meaning. They're independent now. They just boss around whoever they want now. But originally, that's what it meant. All the other meanings of cardinal come from that. The cardinal numbers are attached to a certain number meaning. Cardinal numbers only go back to the 1800s. Georg Cantor, who I'm sure you've read about in your spare time, was the mathematician who invented the cardinal numbers. And the bird cardinal and the other meanings of cardinal come from the Catholic use of it. They're colorful robes of their officials. But it's just an interesting thing. A lot of words, cardinal is a great example of one of many words that just means so many different things. Nobody ever thinks of it as a hinge anymore. And I just point that out because words and specific ways of saying things and specific ways that we like to do things, they are so, so changeable. Nobody thinks of a bird and a cardinal and is reminded of a hinge anymore, but there's a relation there. And the point that I'd like to leave you with today, if you can only get one thing out of the class, if you're an engineer with a short attention span and can only get one thing out of the class, I want to leave you with the fact that words and times and places and human teachers, they come and go all the time. Our time and place someday will be ancient history to someone else. The concept of knowing God, though, it doesn't matter what you call it. You like knowing God, you like relationship with God, you like to call it restoring the New Testament church, you like to call it returning to New Testament Christianity. I'm happy with all of those because it's that idea. It's a powerful one. And brothers and sisters throughout the centuries have given a lot to pursue that very simple goal, something to encourage us and to learn from. Thank you very much for your patient attention. We'll continue next week.